Lecture 5, Privacy and Emotional Distress.
Greetings. Today we're going to talk about privacy and emotional distress, the torts of intentional infliction of emotional distress and invasion of privacy. These are some of the best torts. They're fun ones. We're going to start with intentional infliction of emotional distress. I talked about how the law often doesn't like to permit recovery for emotional distress, a broken heart, something like that, because it's so hard to prove. But in case of intentional infliction of emotional distress, you may recover. I have to admit, this is my favorite tort. The tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress. Let me explain to you its origin, which is an interesting one, too. According to Prosser, there was no tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress until sometime in the 19th century. Remember, torts are common law made by courts. They develop over time as circumstances change. Well, here's what happened in the 19th century. Up until the 19th century, it was fairly uncommon for the upper crust of society to run across some of the poorer blue-collar types. I mean, sure, they had their servants, but they were, of course, very well trained. They didn't run across your average blue-collar types. But when railroads came, and the richer people in the 19th century started taking railroads, you would have these rich people get on the train to go to Boston or somewhere, and they would run across, you know, your basic railroad worker, standard blue-collar type. And this created a problem, because at this time, a true lady could not hear a swear word or a curse word. If a true lady of this era were to hear swearing, she would get the vapors. It was incumbent upon her. She couldn't be a lady if she could stand up to these swear words. So she would have to feel faint and keel over. And apparently what these railroad workers would do was they would swear in the presence of these rich ladies, all of whom would feel compelled to have to faint. And I can just picture these railroad workers having a good time with this. You know, oh, here comes some more, you know, wop, 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 wop. Well, at any rate, this was not acceptable. And the rich people wanted to sue the railroad for this sort of offensive behavior. But there was no established tort for that sort of thing. So they developed the tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress to account for that. Now, notice how this is different from assault. Remember, an assault is where I threaten you and put you in fear of your life. An intentional infliction of emotional distress is not necessarily one that puts you in fear of physical harm. It's just very distressing. And if you wonder how, I'll give you some pretty good examples. The first requirement of intentional infliction of emotional distress is that there be an extreme and outrageous action. We don't want to protect people from little mild insults. We're not going to protect the eggshell sensitivity under this tort. But if someone does something truly outrageous, truly extreme, truly distressing, you are allowed to recover, so long as it's intentional. Well, okay, let me give you some examples. This one may be one of my favorite examples, too. Imagine this bakery. This is a fairly small, family-owned bakery. And they had a store. And in the back, they found a rat running in the alley or something. Someone cornered the rat and clubbed it to death with a shovel, right? And then the trash man hadn't come yet, so they left the rat back there. Well, a woman, I think a regular customer, came in to the bakery and said, I'd like a loaf of bread, the usual, you know. And he says, oh, we have some fresh. Let me go in the back and get it. So he goes in the back, and this impish practical joker sees the rat and perceives that it is approximately the size and weight of a good loaf of crusty bread. So he takes the rat and he puts it in the paper, you know, with the bakery paper, you know, wraps it all up and puts it in a bag and gives it to her. And she sees nothing wrong, so she takes this home. Then it comes, she's getting ready to make her family sandwiches. She gets out her bread knife, she opens it up, and there's this rat, which of course is not just a rat, it's a rat that's been bloodied and beat to death with a shovel, sitting on the stove. That's a case. There's a case of intentional infliction of emotional distress. I mean, there are a lot of these. I have to be careful not to get too carried away. Some of them are most unusual. Some of them are most unusual. Consider the following case. This fellow was very upset with his neighbors. I don't even recall why, but he was very angry with them. And so, in order to get even with the neighbors with whom he was angry, he broke into their kitchen and committed suicide all over their kitchen. Isn't that bizarre? And apparently left blood and himself all over their kitchen. Well, I mean, I suppose he got the worst of it, but then he was sued. Well, his estate was sued. The family where he broke in and committed suicide all over the kitchen, because it became clear that he did this because he was so angry with them and wanted to upset them. The family sued him for intentional infliction of emotional distress, for committing suicide all over their kitchen. And they won. That was intentional infliction of emotional distress. Oh, there are a lot of other cases. I'll put some off till the end, though. One circumstance I want to tell you about is the bill collector cases. Bill collectors got into some trouble for a while in this intentional infliction of emotional distress. Because, you know, these people who collect bills can be pretty... I mean, they're dealing with people who aren't paying, so they think they have to be tough, and they can be very tough. In one such bill collector case, a bill collector came to the house, and there was a little 11-year-old girl there. And he said, "Let me in." And she said, "No, I'm not supposed to let anyone in." He said, "Let me in." She said, "No." He said, "If you don't let me in, I'll have you arrested." And he goes into detail, "I'll take her down to jail," and, you know, blah, blah. And she became terribly frightened and let him in. But that was a case of intentional infliction of emotional distress on the young girl. Now, so extreme and outrageous actions, what does that mean? Well, some pretty radical practical jokes would fall in. As a general rule, insulting words are not enough. As a general rule, insulting words are not sufficient to constitute intentional infliction of emotional distress. There's got to be something more than just words. Okay, this is an intentional tort, so there is an intent requirement. You must have done this intentionally. Well, we've talked about intent before. You have some idea of what an intent requirement is. It doesn't necessarily mean you meant to put someone in the hospital, but it means you took you made an outrageous act, you did it intentionally, and you did it with at least reckless disregard for the consequences. You probably should have known that this would cause these consequences. You may have thought it was just a cute, clever, practical joke. You probably should have known that it would have these serious intentional consequences. That's all the intent requirement that there is. But also, it's got to be productive of actual severe emotional distress. Once again, we don't want people go around suing other people every time they say something funny but insulting, or every time they pull a practical joke. It's got to be productive of actual severe distress. Now, what sort of emotional distress are we talking about? Well, it can be difficult to measure, even to identify emotional distress attributable to an episode. The things that most often come up, though, are loss of sleep or nightmares. Those are the sort of forms of emotional distress you can put your finger on. I haven't been able to sleep. I've suffered these extreme nightmares. And generally, how do you prove it? Well, one way you prove it is by seeking medical aid. Some people have become so distressed they've sought medical aid from either a regular physician or a therapist. And that's one way of proving emotional distress and also of establishing some tangible damages for that emotional distress. Again, we use a reasonable person standard here. We use a reasonable person standard. That means that if you're just terribly sensitive and you get the vapors over the slightest little episode, you're not going to be able to recover for that slightest little episode. It has to be something dramatic. Well, the cases I've told you so far were pretty dramatic. And it has to be dramatic like that in order to recover for intentional infliction of emotional distress. And proximate cause, again, as you must always prove that this was the proximate cause of your emotional distress in order to recover. This means that if something else traumatic went on in your life at the same time, you may have difficulty proving that your emotional distress was due to this tort. Okay, I'm going to throw in a case here, a good business-related case, to give you an example. And perhaps an example of where the customer may not always exactly be right. This involved a Kmart store. And Kmart had hired a young woman of high school age to do the checkout at the store. And another woman who actually knew this girl was shopping at Kmart. and brought a big pack group of things to the checkout counter to buy. And one of them was curtains or something in the back of the store. And, you know, the young woman, whose name was Bodwig, was, you know, doing the cash register and putting all these things in. And when she rang up the curtains, the woman who was shopping there said, "Wait, that's not the price. They're on sale." And, "Well, this is the price I have." "Well, okay," so she, you know, gets on a price check and I'll, you know, and somebody comes. Now, the woman was sort of cynical and mistrustful, and she didn't trust the guy to go back there and get the price, so she followed the guy back there to get the price, okay? Well, they come back, and it turns out the store was right. After all, they weren't on sale. So she's checked out, and the checker says, "Your money, please." She said, "Oh, I left a $20 bill right there." And the woman at the checkout stand said, no, there was no $20 bill." She said, "I know, I left a $20 bill right there." "No, I don't think you did." And the woman started to create a big scene and said, "This woman took my $20 bill. This young lady stole my money." And, of course, what do? Well, they check her cash register, and it all checks out right. But the woman isn't satisfied. She insists that they conduct a strip search of the young lady who was working the cash register. So they take her back there, and they strip her down to where you can see everything. In fact, there's no $20 bill there. And they ask the woman, "Why, are you sure you left a $20 bill there? Why do you think you had a $20 bill there? How much money did you have in your purse?" She says, "Oh, $500 or $600, I'm not sure. I don't know why you'd carry around that much cash to a Kmart, but she was." So she really didn't know she had a $20 bill there, but she created this big disturbance, and even as she left, she was pretty insistent that somebody had stolen her money. And the next day, when young Miss Bodwig goes to work at Kmart, Kmart is showing mistrust of her. They have her piggybacked at the cashier stand, which means they've got somebody keeping an eye on her, working with her and watching her. Well, this whole episode is very distressing to her, whether it's the strip search or the lack of trust in her or the combination of all of them. So she started having trouble sleeping. She suffered a lot of severe emotional distress, and she sued Kmart for this, and she won. Okay? They were just out of hand in the strip search, I think, and in showing the lack of trust, even after there was no evidence whatsoever that she had stolen. Okay, so that's a business example of intentional infliction of emotional distress. I'll give you some later. Now I want to talk briefly about negligent infliction of emotional distress. Negligent infliction of emotional distress. Here, I have discussed that in general you can't recover for negligent infliction of emotional distress. You certainly can't recover in the circumstances of, say, a relationship. But the laws have slowly expanded to permit people to recover in some limited circumstances of negligent infliction of emotional distress. For example, some states will permit you to sue for infliction of emotional distress where you've also suffered a physical impact or an injury. We've also suffered a physical impact or an injury. If somebody hurts you physically or just touches you in the course of inflicting emotional distress, you may be able to recover. Others have permitted recovery for negligent infliction of emotional distress if you are in the zone of physical danger, even if there was no actual physical danger to you. Some other states have permitted it where you witness harm to a close relative. There was a case where a fellow was sitting on the steps waiting for his son to come visit him and meet him for lunch. And as his son was crossing the street, a very negligent driver ran over and hit his son. He wanted to sue, the son has a case, and in the case of death, the son's survivors have a case. But the father wanted to sue also for the emotional distress he suffered from watching his son be run down by a car. And they said, yes, you can, because that person was a close relative and you were an eyewitness to the episode. So there are some limited circumstances for recovery of negligent infliction of emotional distress. Now, the next main topic in this lecture is invasion of privacy. You can recover for several different types of invasion of privacy. The first type of invasion of privacy is intrusion. Intrusion into your private affairs, your private areas. A peeping Tom is an intruder. You can sue a peeping Tom for looking in your window. Eavesdropping can be intrusion. Unauthorized eavesdropping on your telephone calls is a tort. It's a tort of invasion of privacy in the form of intrusion. And likewise, an improper or unlawful search of you could also be intrusion. Bodwig might have been able to sue for this form of invasion of privacy in intrusion. Now, to win for intrusion, you have to show several things. First, there must be a reasonable expectation of privacy. You can't sue for intrusion into your area of privacy unless you have a reasonable expectation of privacy, which means if you leave something in plain sight, you may not be able to claim that that was an invasion of privacy. There are a lot of cases where they give you a locker. Say you go to work and they give you a locker. Now, do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the contents of your locker at work? Maybe yes, maybe no. It depends. What has the employer told you? Has the employer told you, we will retain a key to this locker and we'll search it at any time we feel like it? Well, if they tell you that in advance, you don't have much of a reasonable expectation of privacy, so you can't have much intrusion. On the other hand, if the employer promises you that under no, this is your private, well, under no circumstances will we look into it, you have the only key, then maybe you do have a reasonable expectation of privacy there. What are some examples? Well, one case, there was a woman who went to a fun house, you know, some sort of amusement park type place, and they had a little Marilyn Monroe thing where the wind would blow up from below and blow your dress up around your head, right? Well, she did this, and someone took a picture of it and published it, and she was able to win for intrusion on her privacy. Another person, though, tried to bring an intrusion case when a landlord, they were apartment renters, and a landlord came by their house on Sunday morning to collect the rent. And they said, this was an intrusion of our privacy. How dare you barge in on us on Sunday morning to collect our rent? The court said, no. You don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy that someone will not come to the door on Sunday morning. So intrusion is one form of invasion of privacy. A second form of invasion of privacy is publicity of your private life. If someone publicizes your private life, you can sue them for invasion of privacy. Now, it doesn't have to be publicized to everyone. Just telling your neighbor about your private life is some form of invasion of your privacy. Oh, there are some cases here, too. I'll tell you the case about the Oklahoma preacher. There was a woman in the congregation of this Oklahoma church, and she had not been a regular attender at church, I guess. One day she was absent, and the preacher decided to sermonize on her. And he told all these details about her, told how, you know, you notice she's not been coming to church, and here are the consequences. And he said she was having an affair with such and such a person, and she was misbehaving in this other way. She was getting drunk with such and such another person. And this was, he said this from the church. Now, she wasn't too pleased with that. She wanted to sue him. Now, you may think, well, she could sue him for defamation, right? Well, maybe not. Maybe it was all true. I mean, the preacher got his facts straight, perhaps. Does that mean that it's okay for him to do what he did? No, not necessarily. He invaded her privacy by publicizing her private life when there was no need to do so. So that was a case of invasion of privacy, publicity of private life. Well, you notice truth is not a defense here. If just because it's true is not a defense, you still can't publicize even true facts about someone's private life. But there is an important defense of newsworthiness. Newsworthiness. This is why someone can tell about Michael Jackson's or Roseanne Arnold's private life or something. Now, you may not really think that's all that newsworthy, but people are interested in it. It's newsworthiness. If it's in a private fact that's important, if it's something about, I mean, the Clintons' real estate Whitewater deal is in some respects private, but it's certainly newsworthy in the sense that the public has reason to suspect there may have been something wrong here. It should at least be investigated. There was an Iowa case of the husband and the hussy. A cabin burned down. A cabin in an Iowa neighborhood burned down. And this was reported in the paper. And they reported in the paper that in the cabin was this man who was married and this woman who was not his wife. And the wife sued, saying this invaded our privacy. You know, you sort of publicized the fact my husband was having an affair. But that was not an inappropriate invasion of privacy, not a wrongful publication of private life, because a fire in which people die is newsworthy, and there's an interest in publicizing that information. Okay, now there's a third important type of invasion of privacy, and that is misappropriation of likeness. If someone takes your likeness, meaning your picture, or perhaps even the sound of your voice, and uses it to sell their product, that is a form of invasion of privacy for which you can sue. Now, when somebody's advertising something, they typically will use the name or likeness or voice of a celebrity. Those celebrities, of course, will sue, and they know that, and they have to get the celebrity's permission in order to use their name or likeness. But not always. There have been some other cases. There was a series of ads for Playboy, which you may remember if you're as old as I am, which was, what kind of man reads Playboy? And they'd show these pictures of, you know, people reading Playboy. Now, sometimes it might be a big movie star. What kind of man reads Playboy? Well, a big movie star does. But one picture was of a soldier over in Vietnam, had the Playboy in his backpack. What kind of man reads Playboy? You know, a soldier. Well, they didn't get his permission. This had just been some news wire photo picture of this guy that happened to have a Playboy in it. Playboy saw this, thought, oh, that's great. What kind of, they used it without getting the permission of the soldier. That was a misappropriation of his likeness. He had a right to sue Playboy for some compensation for this. So what sort of likeness are we talking about here? If they use your face, something identifiable, then yes, that's a misappropriation of your likeness. If you have a distinctive voice, we'll talk about that. If you have a distinctive voice, that's a misappropriation of your likeness. But not probably for a picture of your hand. If somehow your hand cut into an advertisement, that's probably not a misappropriation of your likeness. Also not for a picture of your house. If you have a very nice house, they decided to use your house in an ad campaign, that's also not been held not to be a misappropriation of your likeness. There was a manufacturer of portable porta-potties, you know, the things that construction workers have out there when they're working on a construction site, portable toilets. And they cleverly thought, we will call our portable toilets, Here's Johnny. Well, that was a misappropriation of the likeness of Johnny Carson, of course. How about this case? Ford Automobile Company wanted to get Bette Midler to sing the theme or whatever for their advertisements. Well, they couldn't get her. I don't know if they couldn't pay her enough or if perhaps she just doesn't want to do advertisements. Whatever reason, they couldn't get her. So they did the next best thing. They got a Bette Midler sound alike. You may be aware that there are people out there who actually make a living by looking like famous people, looking like Woody Allen or Jacqueline Onassis or Burt Reynolds or somebody like that. And similarly, there are people who can make a living by imitating and sounding like Bette Midler. So they used a Bette Midler sound-alike voiceover on this Ford commercial. And they nowhere said this is not Bette Midler. They just left it to people's imagination who this was. Well, Bette Midler sued. This was the worst of all possible worlds. She wasn't on the advertisement. She did not get paid in the advertisement, but everybody thought she was because the sound-alike was so good at it. And she won. That was held to be a misappropriation of her likeness, of her distinctive sound, which of course she has, her distinctive sound, and thus she won. Okay, there was an actress named Robin Douglas who had posed a large number of times for Playboy magazine, 8 or 10 or something like that. And then Hustler magazine, which is another, you know, pornographic magazine, published photos of her, and she sued for misappropriation of her likeness. And Hustler magazine claimed, well, hey, how can she complain? I mean, these same pictures have been all over Playboy, and we think they're in the public domain, blah, blah, blah. The court said, no, there's a difference between Playboy and Hustler magazine. And when Hustler did this, that was a misappropriation of her likeness. Okay, is there any defense in the case of misappropriation of likeness? Yes. If the photographs are in the public domain, say from movies, you might be able to take a photograph of someone from a movie already held to be considered to be in the public domain and use that. You've given up any claim to misappropriation of your likeness. Also, there's a newsworthiness exception. I mean, if you read a newspaper, you know that every day there are pictures in the newspaper of all sorts of people, often President Clinton or someone like that, but Tanya Harding, who knows who else, pictures of everybody. Can these people sue for misappropriation of likeness? No, because the reason they're in the newspaper is that they've done something newsworthy, and that is a legitimate basis for the publication. Misappropriation of likeness is usually limited to advertising. Okay, I want to talk about, before we get to cases, and I have a lot of fun cases here, before we get to these cases, I want to talk a little bit about the concept of employee testing for something such as drugs, because this is controversial. If you go to work for a company, they say, we're going to give you a drug test. You have to take a drug test. Well, you don't like that. You object to that. You want to sue. Can you sue? Could this be an intentional infliction of your emotional distress? I mean, under some circumstances, I might see it, could see how it might be. Could this be an invasion of your privacy? Certainly seems as though in some cases that some types of drug testing might well be invasion of your privacy. So can you sue for those torts? Almost certainly not. Almost always lose, at least in the case of private employment. Why? Because of the defense of consent. Remember we talked about how you can consent to a tort against you, like Emmett Smith can consent to being tackled in a battery. Likewise, when you agree to work for that place, you are deemed to have consented to their rules. If you don't want the drug test, you consider an invasion of your privacy or an infliction of emotional distress, you have an answer, right? Quit the job. May not seem like a very satisfying answer to you. You need this job. You don't want to quit the job. But when you take the job on the terms they've set forth, no drug testing, that's held to be consent, and you can't sue your employer for a tort in most cases. Still could, possibly, if they did it in an unnecessarily or unreasonably intrusive way. Okay, let's talk about some cases. Start with an invasion of privacy case. There was a baker who ran an advertisement for bread. This is a good old one. I like these quaint old ones. Ran an advertisement for bread that said, "Keep that sylph-like figure." You don't even hear many sylphs anymore, but "keep that sylph-like figure by eating more of Melt's rye bread," says Mademoiselle Sally Payne, an exotic red-haired Venus. And there was a picture of a beautiful woman, of course. Well, the picture, though, was not of Sally Payne. It was of some other woman. I don't know where they got it. Picture of some other woman. So can she recover for that, even though they were actually quite complimentary to her in the advertising copy? Can she recover? Sure she can. Under misappropriation of likeness, they invaded her privacy. Possibly for other reasons, too, but certainly under misappropriation of likeness. Okay? How about this one? A marriage fell apart. A former husband brought a libel suit against his wife. And the libel suit, the defamation case, was because she slandered him by stating that he had a homosexual affair with another man. She said this about him after their divorce. Well, he sued her for defamation. So she believes this is true. She wants to prove it. So what does she do? She decides she's going to match this suspicious hair she found in her husband's bed. While they were married, I guess she collected the hair from her husband's bed, at least the hair that was neither hers nor his. So she collected up this hair she found in her husband's bed. Then that was a start. Then she thinks, this is evidence that my husband slept with someone who has this hair. Then she suspects that this other fellow was his homosexual lover. So she takes steps to get hair samples from the other fellow. And one thing she did was, this guy was in the hospital. She had a friend who went to a nurse in the hospital to get hair samples from the room that the guy was staying in and from his hairbrush. You know, the hospital would give this guy a hairbrush, he'd brush his hair, some hair would come out. In my case, a lot of hair comes out. They take that, and she took it out and she matched it up. Well, is that legit? Is that appropriate? The other man, to this day, I don't know if they were actually having an affair, but the other man sued the ex-wife for invasion of privacy. Is that fair? Is that right? Yes, that was an invasion of his privacy. That was an intrusion, and he wins that case for invasion of privacy. Okay, let's do a intentional infliction of emotional distress case. That's a good Louisiana case. Louisiana's a source of all sorts of great cases. A fellow had been in a truck automobile accident that was just terrible. Just a terrible, awful accident. In fact, his car was struck from the side and was struck so hard that he actually literally fell to pieces. His survivors made arrangements with a funeral home to have him buried. So the people in the funeral home went and got the body and put it in a casket and had a nice ceremony and had him buried. Then the survivors, for whatever reason, went out to visit the scene of the accident. They went out to where the truck was, and they looked in the truck, and they discovered that some parts from the fellow were still there. A foot, a leg, something like that. They were very distressed. They called up the funeral home and said, in distress, and said, how can you do this? How can you have done this to us? Well, I don't know if that alone would be intentional infliction of emotional distress, but the people at the funeral home said, no, we don't believe, we'd never do that. So they drove, show us. So somebody from the funeral home went out there and met people from the family and showed him these body parts in the truck. And the guy from the funeral home got all upset and angry and said, pulled out a hefty bag and said, we've picked up all the parts we're going to pick up. Here, you want to pick up these parts, lady? Get them yourself. And threw a hefty bag at her. That was intentional infliction of emotional distress. Okay, I got another quick funeral case for you. A large person, a large woman, was to be buried. And they consequently found a nice large casket for her. And they went through the whole ceremony at the gravesite. And it was very lovely. And they had this casket. And then everyone left. Well, unfortunately, the people who had dug the hole for the burial had dug a standard-sized hole, and this extra-large casket would not fit in the standard-sized hole. So this created a problem. What developed was, as the family was leaving in an already emotional state, having gone through the funeral for one of their loved ones, these bereaved people drove by around a circle and back by and discovered the grave site workers jumping up and down on the coffin trying to get it into the hole. That did not please them, and they sued and recovered for intentional infliction of emotional distress. Okay, here's a made-up case that shows some of the tricks to this intentional infliction of emotional distress. I go up to someone and I want to shoot her in the back of the head. I would never do this, but I want to shoot her in the back of the head and kill her without notice. I don't want to scare her, I just want to kill her. Right? So, just as I'm about to pull the trigger, someone sees me. A third party intervenes, rushes in, and knocks the gun away from me. My intended victim learns of this fact, that she was almost killed. And she suffers great distress as a consequence. She's very upset about this. It's kind of understandable. Now, I didn't actually shoot her, so there was no battery. And I didn't really assault her because she was never aware of this threat when it was extant. So it's not assault, but she still suffers this great distress, so she sues me for an intentional infliction of emotional distress. Should she be able to recover in that case? Probably no. Because remember, intentional infliction of emotional distress is an intentional tort. I must have done an act with the intent, or where it was reasonably foreseeable that this would happen. I had no intent to cause her, I didn't intend to kill her, but I had no intent to cause her emotional distress, nor was it reasonably foreseeable to me that I would cause her emotional distress, because I had no plan that she would know anything about this until after she was already dead. So I didn't behave very well, but it was not this tort. Okay, let me skip away from the cases for a moment and talk about a pretty common controversy in the news, and that is, should you be able to disclose the names of a rape victim? And the limits to the common law here. There was a time when there was a famous case, a famous rape case. The newspaper would publish the name of the rape victim. And this would cause the victim severe emotional distress. Being known as somebody who is a victim of rape could be, I mean, obviously being a victim of rape could be enormously distressing. Being known that way by the public could be even more so. And these people would want to sue the newspaper for intentional infliction of emotional distress, but they could not. And they would want to sue the newspaper for invasion of their privacy, but they could not. Why? Because it was considered to be newsworthy. Remember, we have this newsworthiness defense to all of these torts. And this was considered to be newsworthy. I mean, a rape is obviously of concern to the community. So they could not sue. This was considered to be an unfortunate set of events. What happened was the legislature responded. The legislatures in virtually every, if not every state, have now passed laws prohibiting the disclosure of the name of rape victims. And some newspapers have tried to get away with it anyway, but it's against the law to do that. But not because of the tort so much. Common law torts aren't meant to cure every problem, every ill of society. Intentional infliction of emotional distress and invasion of privacy don't always protect you perfectly. Okay, I've got some more good cases. What about, this was a famous, this was a wagon seller case, person's name. She was a nurse at a hospital. And the hospital decided that it could improve the camaraderie, it could improve the efficient functioning of the hospital by going out on one of these, Upward Bound or camping weekends. This is a theory that a lot of people in business have, that you can improve the workplace by putting everybody together out in the woods, making them, sort of live together and fend for themselves. The Minnesota Vikings tried this once. They were a little disappointed in their performance the year before, so they sent the whole team out on one of these Upward Bound things, and the next year their record was worse. So I don't know how much maybe they work. A lot of people think they work. I'll presume they work. Anyway, all the people from this hospital went out there, and wagon seller, the nurse, and all these other people, and they lived out there. Well, one of the things they did was they wanted to make a nice community. In fact, they did almost their own little Club Med in some ways, and they performed a skit. And this skit was something like Moon Over Miami or something, and this skit was to culminate in the members of the cast mooning the audience, dropping their pants and mooning the audience. Well, Wagon Seller, Ms. Wagon Seller, was a little more demure than that. She was supposed to do all this, but she couldn't go along with that. She didn't want to drop her pants and moon the audience. Well, it happened that this terribly annoyed all the rest of her coworkers. They got all upset that she wouldn't moon. They said, "Oh, you're a prude. We don't like you." So she comes back to work, and everyone is ignoring her. No one will talk to her. Her work suffers. She's fired as a consequence. All as a consequence of her not mooning in that skit. What do you think about that one? She was able to sue for wrongful discharge. She was wrongfully fired. There was a theory there that was slightly different, which was that it was contrary to public policy to fire someone for not exposing themselves in public. But that was also a case of intentional infliction of emotional stress, and I suppose invasion of privacy, too. Okay, how about this one? A person worked at a nuclear power plant. While working in this nuclear power plant, she was in an area of high radioactivity. I mean, there are certain parts of the plant that are a little not, that they can't reduce the radioactivity in. Okay, it's an area of high radioactivity. But they give you all this protective gear, I mean, lead-lined things, I guess. So it's supposed to be perfectly safe. There's a lot of radioactivity out there in the air, but it can't get into you, all right? Well, anyway, while she is in this area of high radioactivity, there is this problem. She passes out. Well, this creates quite a stir around the old nuclear power plant, as you can imagine, right? Maybe things, they're not so concerned about worker safety after all. Well, some officials came to her and said, "Well, we're very concerned." They were concerned about worker safety, not like the guy on The Simpsons. "We're very concerned. Why did this happen? Why did you pass out? We have to test you for it." She says, "Don't worry. Don't worry. It had nothing to do with radioactivity. I recently had a hysterectomy, and for whatever reason after this surgery, I have been subject to these spells, for I pass out sometimes." They said, "Oh, good." She says, "But please keep this a secret." I don't want everybody knowing, you know, I don't want to broadcast all over the world that I had a hysterectomy. They say, okay. So they keep it secret. Well, but rumors are spreading all over the plant. The workers at the plant are very upset. They think that proper safety precautions are not being taken to protect them because this woman passed out. There's talk of people leaving. There's talk of striking. There's very upset. So eventually, to calm all these rumors, the people at the company tell about the hysterectomy. She then sues for invasion of privacy. They promise not to tell. Should she win? What do you think? Court says no. The court says no. Because of all the concern among the workers, this was like a newsworthiness case. This was a very newsworthy explanation to the people working there because they needed reassurance that the workplace was safe. So she did not win for invasion of privacy. Okay, here's another one. I don't know if you remember, but at one point in San Francisco, President Gerald Ford was visiting San Francisco, and a woman, Squeaky Fromm, I believe she was, attempted to assassinate him. An ex-Marine in the crowd saw her pull out the gun and grabbed the gun and possibly saved President Ford. He became something of a hero. So there were all these articles about him. Well, it happens that this hero was prominent in the local gay community. And this came out in the articles. So what functionally happened is after he performed this heroic act of grabbing the gun, he was outed. His homosexuality was publicly exposed in these newspaper articles. And he sued for invasion of privacy because of that. Does he win? No. This is held to be newsworthy. The court said first, we don't think, you know, saying you're gay is such a terribly offensive fact, particularly in San Francisco. And second, this is good. We need these kind of stories so people realize that gay people can be heroes too. And we think this was newsworthy, and so you can't sue for invasion of privacy. Well, there's a lot of controversy about outing this person or that person. Can you tell that this so-and-so is gay? And there's a potential invasion of privacy claim there. But it's not necessarily an invasion of privacy. You think your sexual preference, your sexual orientation is private, and it generally should be. But in some cases, that may be a newsworthy fact. If you know, there's a right-wing congressperson who's been bashing gays, you know, saying that they all should be thrown in jail or something, and it turns out he is gay, that's a newsworthy fact, and so you can publish that. Okay, let me tell you another interesting, perhaps unusual case. From Texas, I have to admit it. There were some fellows associated with a fraternity, I think, and one of them had sex with a woman, you know, someone at the university, and taped it, you know, had a video camera in there and taped this sex act, and then they thought it would be funny. They were young. They thought it would be funny to pass around this tape to all their buddies, so all their buddies could see this tape of this woman, you know, in the midst of sex. Well, it's got around, spread around so much, she found out about it. And she sued them for emotional distress. Well, that makes sense. That seems like a good case, right? But there's a problem. There was a big problem in her case. This seems like a clear-cut case to me of intentional infliction of emotional distress. They took an act passing around this tape, which would obviously cause emotional distress. It was meant to humiliate her. But she didn't sue for intentional infliction of emotional distress. She sued for negligent infliction of emotional distress. Why? Because the insurance policy that was applicable did not cover intentional torts. There was an insurance policy that she could reach if it was negligent, but the insurance policy did not extend to intentional torts. So had she sued for intentional infliction of emotional distress, she might have been able to recover from these few college guys who passed around the tape, but they didn't have much money. She wanted to reach the deep pocket of the insurance company. So she sued for negligent infliction of emotional distress, and she lost. It was intentional. It wasn't really negligent. Second, It's hard to recover from negligent infliction of emotional distress. Remember, I've explained that to you. She did not fall within one of these zones that's recognized by the state of Texas. I mean, some other states might have allowed it, but not Texas. So she lost. And even people with good cases sometimes lose, sometimes because the defendant doesn't have any money. It seems kind of unfair, but that's the way it is. Okay, that should be enough fun examples of these torts. Thank you.